fingerprints were on the laudanum bottle. "I grew up in Aztlan," she began, "in the same village where El Patrón was born. It was poor then, and it's worse now. Nothing grew there except weeds, and they were so bitter that they made the donkeys throw up. Even roaches hitchhiked to the next town. That's how bad it was. As a girl, I went to work in a maquiladora, a factory on the border. All day I sat on an assembly line and put tiny squares into tiny holes with a pair of tweezers. I thought I'd go blind. We lived in a big gray building with windows so small you couldn't put your head outside. That was to keep the girls from running away. At night, we climbed to the roof and looked north, across the border."
"Our border?" asked Matt.
"Yes. The farms lie between Aztlan and the United States. You couldn't see much because the farms are dark at night. But beyond, where the United States lay, was a great glow in the sky. We knew that under that glow was the most wonderful place. Everyone had his own house and garden. Everyone wore beautiful clothes and ate only the best food. And no one worked more than 4 hours a day. The rest of the time, people flew around in hovercrafts and went to parties."
"Is that true?" asked Matt,
who knew almost nothing about the countries bordering the farms.
"I don't know," Celia sighed. "I guess it's too good to be true."
Matt helped Celia clear the dishes, and together they washed and dried. It reminded him of those days, long ago, when they lived in the little house in the poppy fields. Matt waited patiently for Celia to pick up the story again. He knew if he pushed her too hard, she'd stop talking about her past.
"I lived in that gray building forever, getting older and older. No parties, no boyfriends, no nothing," she said at last after the dishes were put away. "I hadn't heard from my family in years. Maybe they were all dead. I didn't know. The only change in my life happened after I learned to cook. I was taught by an old curandera, a healing woman who took care of the girls. She taught me all kinds of things. I was the best student she ever had, and soon I got off the assembly line and started cooking for the whole building. I had more freedom. I went to the market to buy herbs and food. And one day, I met a coyote."
"An animal?"
Matt was confused.
"No, darling. A man who takes people over the border. You pay him, and he helps you go to the United States. Only first, you have to cross the farms."
Celia shivered.
"What an idiot I was. Those people don't help you go anywhere. They lead you straight to the farm patrol." "I packed everything I owned, including the Virgin I had brought from my village. About 20 of us crossed into the Ajo Mountains, and that's where the coyote abandoned us. We panicked like a bunch of scared rabbits. We tried to climb down a cliff, and a woman fell into a gorge and died. We abandoned most of our belongings so we could move faster, but it didn't do us any good. The farm patrol was waiting at the foot of the mountains. I was taken to a room, and my backpack was dumped out. 'Be careful,' I cried. 'Don't hurt the Virgin.' That's how she got the chip on her robe, when the patrol dumped her on the floor. They laughed, and one of them was going to crush her with his foot when someone shouted, 'Stop!' from the doorway. Everyone snapped to attention then, you better believe it. It was El Patrón in his wheelchair. He was stronger in those days, and he liked to check up on things personally. 'Your accent is familiar. Where are you from?' he asked. I told him the name of my village, and he was very surprised. 'That's my hometown,' he said. 'Don't tell me the old rat's nest is still there.' 'It is,' I said, 'only the rats have moved on to a better slum.' He laughed and asked if I had any skills. From that moment on, I belonged to El Patrón. I'll always belong to him. He'll never let me go." Matt felt cold. It was good that Celia had crossed over the border. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been around to care for him. But there was something so bleak about her last words. "He'll never let me go." "I love you, Celia," Matt said impulsively, putting his arms around her. "And I love you," she said softly, hugging him back.
It felt so safe then. Matt wished he could hide in her apartment forever
and forget about the alacrangs, the scornful servants, and McGregor's clone.
What happened to the other people who crossed the border? He asked.
Them? Celia's voice was flat and expressionless. They were all turned into Egypts. And she refused to say any more about it. Old age. 12 to 14. Chapter 15. A starved bird. The days passed with unvarying sameness. Now Matt could no longer look forward to Maria's visits. Both she and Emilia had been sent to a convent to turn them into proper young ladies.
Maria's the one they're trying to tame, Celia said. Emilia's about as wild as a bowl of oatmeal.
Matt asked Celia to send Maria a letter, but she refused. The nuns would only hand it over to Senator Mendoza, she said. Matt tried to imagine what she was doing, but he knew nothing about convents. Did she miss him? Had she forgiven him? Was she visiting Tom instead? With Maria and Emilia gone, Benito and Stephen went elsewhere for their vacations. Mr. Alacrán was away on frequent business trips, and Felicia and El Viejo stayed in their rooms. The halls and gardens were deserted. The servants still went about their duties, but their voices were muted. The house was like a stage, with all the actors missing. One day, Matt ordered a safe horse from the stables and waited tensely to see whether the request would be denied. It wasn't. An Egypt brought out the animal. Matt, uncomfortable, cast his eyes down. Few Egypts worked in the house, and he preferred not to think about them. He reached for the reins and glanced up.
It was Rosa.
Matt felt that old thrill of terror, as though he were still a small boy and she his jailer. But this woman posed no threat at all. The hard, bitter lines of her face seemed unconnected with anything going on inside. Rosa gazed straight ahead with her hand outstretched. It was unclear whether she even saw him.
Rosa, Matt said.
She looked at him.
Do you wish another horse, master?
The voice was the same, but the old anger was gone.
No, this one is fine, Matt said.
Rosa turned and shuffled back into the stables. Her movements were jerky compared to what he remembered. Matt rode away from the house. The horse walked steadily. It would move in a straight line until Matt told it to go right or left, and it wouldn't pass the boundary implanted in its brain. Like Rosa, Matt thought. For the first time he realized what a terrible thing it was to be in Egypt. He hadn't known any of the others before their operation. They were simply there to do boring jobs. But Rosa had been a real, though cruel and violent, person. Now she was merely a shadow with the life sucked out of her. On an impulse, he turned the animal west rather than east and skirted the poppy fields to where he thought Celia's little house lay. He shaded his eyes to make out its shape. This part of the farm was at an early stage in the growing cycle. The plants were hardly more than a gray-green shadow, and a gentle mist wafted up from sprinklers in the ground. The air was sharp with the smell of wet dust. A few Egypts bent over the earth, tweezing up weeds and squashing bugs. This was their country, the country of the Egypts. Matt wondered what would happen if they suddenly woke up. Would they turn on him like the villagers in that movie about Frankenstein? But they wouldn't wake up. They couldn't. They'd go on weeding until the foreman told them to stop. Matt couldn't find the little house. It must have been torn down when he and Celia moved. Sighing, he turned east toward the oasis in the mountains. When he got to the water trough, Matt alit and filled it from the pump as Tamlin had always done. Drink, he told the horse. Obediently, it slurped until Matt decided it had had enough. Stop, he said. He led it into the shade and told it to wait. He felt a whisper of fear as he walked into the mountains. This time he was alone. This time no one would come to his aid if he fell off a rock or was bitten by a rattlesnake. He got to the hole in the rock and climbed through. The pool was low, since it was the end of the dry season and the thunderstorms of August and September were yet to come. The branches of a creosote bush trembled on the other side as some animal slunk into hiding.
Wind whistled through the bare rocks with a lonely, keening sound. Matt sat down and took out a sandwich. He didn't know what he was doing here. At the upper end of the little valley was the grapevine sprawled over its man-made arbor. Someone had lived here long ago, and the vine had grown so heavy, part of the arbor had collapsed. Matt walked carefully into its shade, keeping his eyes peeled for snakes that also liked the cool dark. He saw a large metal chest on the ground. On one side was a roll of blankets and a cache of water bottles. Matt halted. His heart started to gallop. He glanced around to see where the intruder was hiding. There was nothing except the keening wind and the rasping call of a cactus wren somewhere in the rocks. Matt retreated into the cover of a creosote bush. The oily leaves broke against his skin and released a pungent smell. Who had dared to invade his special place? Was it an illegal trying to reach the United States? Or had one of the Egypts woken up? As Matt considered the possibilities, he realized that no illegal could have hauled a metal chest through the dry hills and canyons Celia had described. And no Egypt ever woke up. Heart thumping, Matt ventured from his hiding place and examined the chest. It was secured by two metal clasps. Carefully, he undid the clasps and lifted the lid. On top of neatly packed parcels was a note. "Dear Matt," it began. Matt sat back in the dirt and breathed deeply to contain his shock. This stuff was for him. When he'd calmed down, he took up the note again. "Dear Matt," it said, "I'm a lazy writer, so this won't be long. El Patron says I have to go with him. I can't do anything about it. I put supplies in this chest, plus books. You never know when you might need things. Your friend, Tamlin." It was written in a large, childish scrawl. It surprised Matt to see how poor the man's writing was, when his speech was so intelligent. Tamlin had said he'd never been educated, and here was the proof of it. Matt eagerly unpacked the chest. He found beef jerky, rice, beans, dried onions, coffee, and candy. He found a bottle of water purification pills, a first aid kit, a pocket knife, matches, and lighter fluid. "Pots in blankets," said another note halfway down. Matt immediately unwrapped the blankets and found a nest of cooking utensils and a metal mug. At the bottom of the chest were books. One had fold-out maps, and another was titled A History of Opium. Two more were manuals on camping and survival. A note at the very bottom read, "Keep chest closed. Coyotes eat food. Books, too." Matt sat back and admired the treasures. Tamlin hadn't deserted him after all. He read and reread the last words of the note, and it was like drinking many cups of fresh, cool water. "Your friend, Tamlin." Then Matt packed everything up, stowed the chest in the shadows, and made his way back home. The house was in turmoil when he got there. Hovercrafts landed, servants ran to and fro. Matt found Celia waiting anxiously inside the apartment. "Where have you been, mi vida?" she cried. "I was about to send out a search party. I've laid your suit on the bed." "What happened? Why is everyone running around?" he asked. "No one told you." She distractedly pulled off his shirt and thrust a towel at him. "Take a quick shower before you get dressed. El viejo is dead." Celia hastily crossed herself and left. Matt stared at the towel as he collected his thoughts. The old man's death wasn't a surprise. He hadn't emerged from his room in months, and he'd clearly been very sick. Matt tried to feel sorry, but he hardly knew the man. Matt showered and dressed as rapidly as possible. "I didn't tell you to wash your hair," wailed Celia when she saw him. She combed it down frantically. She was wearing a fine black dress with jet beads sewn on the front, and Matt thought she looked strange without her apron. "El patrón insisted on us being present," Celia said as they hurried through the halls. They came out to the salon. The statues had been replaced by pots of flowers. Black crepe hung in swags around the walls, and hundreds of holy candles glittered in a rack at one end of the room. The smoke and pall of incense made Matt break into a coughing fit. Everyone,
and there were at least 50 people in the salon, turned to frown at him. Celia handed him the inhaler she always carried. Presently, Matt's wheezing subsided, and he was able to look around the room. In the center was an elegantly carved coffin with brass handles. Inside, looking more like a starved bird than anything else, was El Viejo. He was dressed in a black suit, and his sharp nose stuck up like a beak against the ivory silk lining. Celia wept softly, dabbing her eyes with a handkerchief, and Matt felt bad about that. He hated to see her cry. The mourners kept their distance from the coffin. They clustered against the walls and made low conversation. Matt saw Benito, Stephen, and Emilia. Stephen and Emilia were holding hands. The crowd thickened. McGregor entered, looking 30 years younger than the last time Matt had seen him. Now he really did look like Tom, and Matt felt an unreasoning surge of dislike. The hot, close smell of burning candles made his head swim. He wished he could go outside. On the far side of the house was a huge swimming pool that was hardly used by anyone except Felicia, when she was sober. Matt thought about the swimming pool now, with its cool blue depths. He imagined himself skimming along the bottom.
"Don't say anything,"
whispered Celia in his ear. If she hadn't waked him, he would have missed Maria's entrance on the far side of the salon. She was taller and thinner, and she looked very adult in her slim black dress. Her hair fell in a shiny veil over her shoulders. She wore diamond earrings and a small black hat trimmed with more diamonds. Matt thought she was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. She was holding hands with Tom. Matt felt Celia grip his arm. He stared at Maria, willing her to look at him, willing her to drop Tom's hand or, even better, push Tom away. Maria melted into the crowd without once glancing Matt's way. El Patrón was rolled into the salon by Tam Lin. Mr. Alacrán was with them. And for the first time, Matt saw signs of real grief on someone's face. Mr. Alacrán went up to El Viejo's casket and kissed the old man on the forehead. El Patrón looked annoyed and signaled Tam Lin to wheel him along the crowd so he could be greeted by people. Matt waited tensely. He wanted desperately to thank Tam Lin, but now was obviously a bad time. Somehow Matt knew the contents of the metal chest were forbidden. He didn't want to get Tam Lin into trouble. But everything stopped when a door opened, and the officiating priest entered. He was followed by boys swinging balls of fuming incense, and a children's choir. Their sweet voices stilled the conversation in the salon. They were dressed in white robes, like a troop of angels. Their hair was neatly combed and their faces scrubbed and shining. They were all about 7 years old, and they were all Egypts. Matt could tell by the empty look in their eyes. They sang beautifully. No one was more able to appreciate good music than Matt, but they didn't understand what they were singing. The children took up their station at the head of the casket.
"Stay," said the priest in a low voice.
Matt had never seen a priest except on TV. Celia went to a small church a mile away through the poppy fields. She walked there early on Sunday mornings, along with a few other servants. She wasn't allowed to eat or even drink coffee before setting out, which was a great hardship for her. But she never missed a service. She never took Matt along either.
"Be still,"
said the priest to the children's choir. They fell silent at once. He intoned a prayer and ended by sprinkling holy water over El Viejo. It didn't eat holes in El Viejo's suit, the way the flying priest's holy water ate through demons on TV. Matt had the vague idea it was something like acid.
"Let us remember the life of our companion," the priest said in a deep, impressive voice.
He beckoned to the audience, but no one responded. Finally, Mr. Alacrán said a few words, and then the priest told everyone to file past to say their final goodbyes. Matt looked up at Celia, hoping they could go now. She seemed grimly determined. She pushed him ahead as they joined the long line of mourners shuffling past the casket. "What am I supposed to do now?" Matt thought. He tried to see what other people were doing when they reached the casket. Most merely nodded and hurried out of the salon. When Matt and Celia arrived, Celia crossed herself and murmured,
"May God be merciful to you."
Matt felt a hand clamp down on his shoulder and pull him out of the line.
"What is this?"
growled the priest. He was a lot bigger close up than he was at a distance.
"El patrón wanted him to come," Celia said.
"This does not belong here," the priest thundered. "This unbaptized limb of Satan has no right to make a mockery of this rite. Would you bring a dog to church?"
The people in line had halted. Their eyes glittered with malice.
"Please, ask el patrón," begged Celia.
Matt couldn't see why she wanted to argue. They weren't going to win, and he couldn't bear all those eyes watching him be humiliated. He looked around desperately, but el patrón had already gone.
"St. Francis would take a dog to church,"
Maria said in a clear, high voice. Where had she come from? Matt turned to find her right behind him. She was even more beautiful close up.
"St. Francis took a wolf to church," she said. "He loved all animals."
"Maria," groaned Emilia, who wasn't far behind.
"Dada will have a fit when he finds out what you're doing. St. Francis preached to a wolf and told him not to eat lambs," Maria went on, ignoring Emilia.
"Miss Mendoza,"
said the priest, speaking much more respectfully than he had to Celia.
"I'm sure your father likes you to express your opinions, but believe me, I'm an expert in these matters. St. Francis spoke to the wolf outside the church."
"Then I shall too," Maria said haughtily.
She took Matt's hand and led him back along the line of mourners.
"You're going to be in big trouble when Dada finds out," called Emilia. "Be sure and tell him," retorted Maria.
Matt was in a kind of daze. Celia hadn't come with them. He was all alone with Maria, being pulled through the halls to some place she decided was safe. He was aware only of the soft warmth of her hand and the spicy perfume she was wearing. It wasn't until they were inside with the door closed that Matt realized they were in the music room. Maria pulled off her hat and ran her fingers through her hair, and suddenly she looked like a little girl again.
"It's so hot," she complained. "I don't know why El Patrón doesn't allow air conditioning."
"He wants everything to be like his old village," Matt said. He could hardly believe his good luck. Maria was here, and with him.
"Then why doesn't he import rats and cockroaches, too? From what I hear, his village was covered with them."
"He only wanted the good things from it," said Matt, trying to pull himself out of his daze.
"Oh, let's not waste our time with that," cried Maria,
throwing her arms around him and giving him a big kiss.
"There, that shows I've forgiven you. Gosh, I've missed you."
"You have?" Matt tried to kiss her back, but she slid out of his arms.
"Then why did you avoid me after the hospital?"
Now he'd done it. He'd reminded her of MacGregor's clone.
"It was a shock," Maria said, growing solemn. I didn't want to tell you..."
"Knew what?"
"Hey, is that people in the hall?"
Matt heard the noise outside as well. He pulled Maria to the closet, pressed the hidden switch, and heard her gasp as the secret passageway opened.
"It's like a spy novel," she whispered as he drew her inside.
Matt closed the door and found the flashlight he kept by the entrance. They tiptoed along the passage with Matt in the lead. Finally, he allowed her to stop and catch her breath. Chapter 16. Brother Wolf.
"It's even hotter in here than outside," Maria said, wiping her face.
"I'll find an empty room we can hide in," said Matt. He showed her the hidden peepholes, and Maria was both repelled and fascinated.
"Don't tell me you sit in here and watch people," she said.
"No," Matt was offended. He wasn't above eavesdropping at a dinner where he wasn't invited. That was simply getting back at people who'd snubbed him. But what she'd suggested was nasty, like peeking through a keyhole.
"You must think I'm a creep." "Hey, I'm not the one with the secret passage. Who do you think made it?"
Maria's whisper sounded explosive next to Matt's ear. It tickled and sent shivers down his neck.
"El patrón, I guess," said Matt.
"That figures. He's so paranoid, he's always spying on people."
"Maybe he needs to."
"He can't be using the peepholes anymore," said Maria. "Can you imagine trying to squeeze a wheelchair in here?"
"Don't make fun of him."
"I'm not, really. Listen, Can we find a room before I melt into a puddle?
Matt rejected several rooms because he'd seen people in them, but at a bend in the passage he remembered a warehouse with computers and other equipment. Everything had been covered with plastic sheets. It seemed to be a place for things that Patrón needed but didn't want in full view to spoil the effect of his old-fashioned house. Matt helped María over a tangle of wires into the darkened room.
Wow, it's cool in here, she said.
It was more than cool, Matt realized. It was icy. It smelled faintly of chemicals. A slight breeze stirred the hair on his arms, and a hum vibrated almost out of the range of his hearing.
I guess computers need air conditioning, he said. Isn't that just typical, María said. We can shrivel up in the heat, but the machines get a first-class hotel room.
They tiptoed around the equipment and spoke in whispers. Matt saw things glowing under the plastic covers. So the machines were on. What were they doing? And what were they for?
Let's sit somewhere and talk, whispered María.
Matt found a nook between two shrouded hulks where he thought they might be warmer. The coolness, at first so welcome, was beginning to get uncomfortable. They sat close together, as they had often done before María was sent away.
I decided to forgive you after reading The Little Flowers of St. Francis, María began. You remember the wolf I talked about? Well, he was a monster who terrorized everybody until St. Francis gave him a talking to. He was sweet as a lamb and never ate anything but vegetables after that.
I didn't know wolves could digest vegetables, said Matt, who had studied biology.
That's not the point. St. Francis didn't say, I'm going to punish you for all the wickedness you've done. He said, Brother Wolf, today is a new day, and you're going to turn over a new leaf.
Matt held his tongue. He wanted to say that he hadn't poisoned Furball and didn't need forgiveness, but he didn't want to spoil Maria's mood.
So I realized I was being unfair and should forgive you. After all, wolves don't know they aren't supposed to eat peasants.
María leaned against him in the blue shadows of the equipment room. Matt's heart turned over.
She was so beautiful, and he had missed her so much. Thank you, he said. So, you have to promise to be good.
Okay, said Matt, who would have promised her anything at that point.
You have to mean it, Brother Wolf. No running off to the henhouse for snacks.
I promise. What do I call you? Saint María?
Oh, no, María said. I'm not a saint. I have all kinds of faults.
I don't believe it, said Matt. María told him about how she struggled not to lose her temper at Emilia, how she copied someone's paper when she forgot to do her homework, and how she ate ice cream when she was supposed to be fasting. Matt, who didn't bother about being good, thought it a waste of time to worry about faults.
Have you been baptized?
He asked.
Yes, they did it when I was a baby.
Is it a good thing?
Well, of course. Without it, you can't go to heaven.
Matt didn't know much about heaven. Hell was mentioned a lot more often in the shows he watched on TV.
What did the priest mean? That I'm an unbaptized limb of Satan?
María leaned against him and sighed.
Oh, Matt, I'm sure St. Francis wouldn't have agreed with him. You aren't evil, only...
Only what?
You don't have a soul, so you can't be baptized. All animals are like that. I think it's unfair, and sometimes I don't believe it. After all, what would heaven be without birds or dogs or horses? And what about trees and flowers? They don't have souls either. Does that mean heaven looks like a cement parking lot? I suppose this is what the nuns call a theological problem.
Do animals go to hell when they die? Said Matt.
No, of course not. You can't get there without a soul either. I guess I thought about it a lot when Furball died. You simply go out, like a candle. I'm sure it doesn't hurt. You're there 1 minute and then you're not. Oh, let's not talk about this.
Matt was astonished to find her crying. She did cry a lot, he remembered. He hugged her and kissed her tear-streaked face.
I don't mind, he whispered. If I had a soul, I'd probably wind up in hell anyway.
They sat together for a long time, saying nothing. The room was so cold they both were shivering.
I do like being with you, María said at last. There's nobody at my school so easy to talk to.
Can't you visit me again? Said Matt.
Dada says I have to stay away. He thinks... Oh, no! I hear voices again.
Matt and Maria jumped up and ran for the door at the same time. She tripped on the wires and he caught her and boosted her into the passageway. He slid the door shut just as the door on the opposite side of the room opened. They stood for a moment to catch their breaths.
Warm at last,
Maria contentedly sighed, rubbing her arms. Matt listened attentively to the voices outside.
That's Tom, he said quietly.
Really? Where's the peephole? Let me see.
I thought you didn't like spying on people.
I only want to peek.
Maria put her eye to the hole.
It is Tom.
And Felicia.
Matt put his ear to the wall so he could hear better.
Find them here, if they're anywhere in the house,
said Felicia's slow, hesitant voice. For an instant, Matt thought she meant the passage, but then he heard the sound of chairs being moved and the whir of a machine.
Hey, that's the salon, said Tom. It's completely empty. El viejo is all alone.
No one cares, Felicia murmured. He was unusable.
What do you mean? Said Tom.
Felicia laughed, a shrill, alarming sound.
His liver was gone. His heart dried up. You can't get transplants from a cancer patient.
I guess he's just compost now,
Tom laughed. Felicia laughed too. Matt was deeply shocked. He couldn't produce tears for El Viejo, but he did feel sorry for him, lying there like a starved bird in his silk-lined coffin. Matt gently moved Maria aside. She didn't protest as he'd expected. She seemed as stunned by what she'd just heard as he was. Matt saw that one of the large computer screens was brilliantly lit. Then he realized it wasn't a computer at all, but some kind of camera. He saw an image of El Viejo with his beak-like nose poking out of the casket. The picture blurred and shifted. Tom was working the controls.
That's the music room, said Felicia.
Matt saw the grand piano, stacks of music, and Maria's black hat sitting on a table. They were there, cried Tom. He moved the camera lens to show all angles of the room. Felicia took over now, and she seemed to have a lot of experience using the viewing screen. She moved rapidly through the house, even showing the servants' quarters and storage closets. She paused over Celia's apartment. Celia had collapsed in a big easy chair with Tamlin not far away.
Where could they have gone?
Said Tamlin, pacing up and down with the restless energy Matt remembered so well. The bodyguard's voice was tinny and faint until Felicia increased the volume.
Maybe they aren't even in the house, said Celia.
It wouldn't take her there, Tamlin said.
How do you know if he was desperate enough?
Careful,
said Tamlin, looking straight into the view screen. Celia changed the subject and began discussing the funeral.
Blast! They know about the cameras, said Tom.
Tamlin knows everything, said Felicia. El patrón dotes on him.
Take her where?
Shouted Tom, smashing his fist onto a table covered with shrouded machines. Something fell over and broke. Felicia grabbed his hand. Matt knew what Celia was talking about. Tamlin must have told her about the hidden oasis. Matt hadn't considered taking Maria there, and he certainly couldn't do it now with everyone hunting for him.
They could be outside, murmured Felicia.
She manipulated the image to show the stables, the swimming pool, the gardens. Matt was startled to see the lotus pond and a pair of ibises lazily stretching their wings.
Let me see, whispered Maria.
Matt moved to one side and pressed his ear to the wall again so he wouldn't miss anything.
Remember this, said Felicia's
slow, insinuating voice.
That's where Furball got snuffed, isn't it?
Said Tom. Maria gasped. Matt realized they must be looking at the pump house.
You know, I saw the little beast that day, said Felicia.
Furball?
Tom said. Felicia giggled.
I meant the clone. I saw wonderful, talented Matt sneaking out of the Mendoza apartment with a dog in his back. What's going on? I thought. So I followed him.
There was a pause. Then Tom said,
Amazing. You can see inside?
The cameras are everywhere. El Padrón used to watch everything. But now he's too old. He turned the job over to his security team. They don't bother, unless there's visitors. I spend a lot of time here.
It's so cold.
The machines are more efficient near freezing. I wear a coat and hardly notice, said Felicia.
Matt could believe that. She was so drugged she probably wasn't much warmer than poor El Viejo in his casket. Did you see Matt kill the dog? Tom asked eagerly. Matt was startled. Why was Tom asking that question when he himself had done the crime? Maria's body wriggled with indignation. Matt hoped she wouldn't forget herself and yell at them.
Matt didn't do it.
Maria flinched, as though she'd been stung.
Oh, he had the laudanum, Felicia went on, but he didn't use it.
Don't tell me the dog found the bottle and offed himself.
Oh, no.
Felicia fell silent. Sometimes it took her several minutes to marshal her thoughts and continue a conversation. Matt wished he could see what was happening, but he had no chance of prying Maria away from the peephole now.
I went to the lotus pond, Felicia said finally. I was so angry at how they treated you at the birthday party. I wanted to kill that abomination El Padrón keeps at his heels.
Matt felt cold. He'd had no idea how much Felicia hated him.
But I had to be satisfied with that filthy, slavering rat Maria called a dog. I keep a small amount of laudanum for my nerves.
She keeps about enough to wipe out a city, Matt thought.
So I poured one of my bottles on the hamburger that idiot clone left behind. Come here, Furball, I called. He didn't want to leave his bag, but I dumped him out on the meat. He ate the whole thing.
How long did it take him to die? Tom asked. But Matt didn't hear the answer. Maria slid to the floor, and he immediately went to her side. She didn't make a sound, but her body trembled and she turned her head from side to side in an agony of grief.
He didn't suffer, Matt whispered as he held her. He didn't even know what was happening.
Maria clung to him, her face streaked by a bar of light from the flashlight Matt had propped against the wall. Finally, she calmed down enough for Matt to check up on what Tom and Felicia were doing. But they had gone, and the viewing screen was shrouded in plastic. He led her back along the passage. Maria said nothing, and Matt didn't know what to do. They hadn't gone far before he saw a large shape holding a flashlight coming toward them. There was hardly room for the shape to fit between the walls.
You utter fools, said Tamlin in a low voice. The whole house is buzzing like a ruddy beehive.
How did you find us? Asked Matt.
El Padrón told me about this passage. He guessed you'd somehow found it. Damn it, Matt, Maria's had enough grief out of you.
Felicia poisoned Furball, Maria said.
What are you talking about?
Tamlin was clearly startled.
I heard her talking to Tom. She was so happy about it. I didn't know people could be that evil.
Maria looked like a wraith in her black dress. Her face was ashen.
You need to lie down, said Tamlin. I'll take you out through El Patron's study. He'll say you were there all the time. He thinks this is pretty amusing, but Senator Mendoza doesn't think it's funny at all.
Oh, Dada, Maria said, as though she'd just remembered she had a father.
Matt, you wait here a few minutes. When the coast is clear, come out wherever you went in, said the bodyguard.
The music room, said Matt.
I should have guessed it. Maria's hat was there.
Matt, said Maria, pulling away from Tamlin for a moment. You let me forgive you for something you hadn't done.
A little extra forgiveness never hurts, said Matt, quoting one of Celia's favorite sayings.
You probably liked letting me make a perfect idiot of myself, she said with a flash of her old spirit. I'd never think you were an idiot, said Matt. Anyhow, I'm sorry I was unfair to you.
We can't stay here, said Tamlin.
I expect you to keep your promise to be good, she went on, looking at Matt. Okay, he replied. And, Brother Wolf, I'll miss you.
This time Maria let Tamlin hurry her down the passage. Matt listened to her footsteps die away in the distance. Chapter 17. The Egypt Pens. The Mendozas left immediately after Maria, pale and miserable, emerged from El Patrón's apartment. El Patrón decamped not long afterward with his bodyguards. Matt was alone again. He couldn't talk to Maria or Tamlin, but knowing they still liked him made all the difference. He studied things he thought they would approve of. He read survival manuals for Tamlin, and a long, confusing book about St. Francis to please Maria. St. Francis loved everyone, from murderous bandits to beggars covered with running sores. There was a picture of one of these in the book. He called a cicada to his finger and said, "Welcome, Sister Cicada. Praise God with your joyful music." St. Francis spoke to everything. Brother Sun and Sister Moon, Brother Falcon and Sister Lark. It gave Matt the warm feeling that the world was one loving family. Very unlike the Alagrangs. But would St. Francis have said, "Brother Clone"? Matt's warm feelings evaporated. He wasn't part of the natural order. He was an abomination. No matter where he was, Matt couldn't rid himself of the sensation he was being watched. It was bad enough to know the security guard spied on him, but far worse to think of Felicia. She was as awful as Tom, only no one suspected it because she seemed so meek. She reminded Matt of one of those jellyfish he'd seen on TV. They floated around the ocean like fluffy pillows, trailing enough venom to paralyze a swimmer. Why hadn't he realized Felicia hated him? Well, to be honest, because most people hated him. It was no big thing, but her malevolence was in a class by itself. Once a week, Matt went to the stables and asked for a safe horse. Before going out, though, he tried to have a conversation with Rosa. He didn't like her. He wasn't sure why he wanted to wake her up, only that it seemed horrible to see her so changed. If there was anything left of Rosa, it was locked in an iron box. He imagined her banging on the walls with her fists, but no one came to open the door. He'd read that coma victims hear everything people say and need voices to keep their brains alive. And so Matt talked to her about everything he'd seen and done that week. But all Rosa ever replied was, "Do you wish another horse, master?" After an hour or so of this, Matt rode off to the oasis. "Hello, Brother Sun," he called. "Would you mind cooling down a bit?" Brother Sun ignored him. "Good morning, Sister Poppies," Matt called to the sea of blinding white flowers. "Hello, Brother and Sister Egypts," he greeted a row of brown-clad workers bending over the fields. One of the most amazing things about St. Francis and his followers was how they gave away their possessions. St. Francis couldn't wait to strip off his shirt and sandals whenever he saw a poor person without them. Brother Juniper, one of St. Francis's friends, even went home naked a lot of the time. Matt thought El Patrón would have a heart attack if anyone told him to give away his belongings. Once Matt passed through the hole in the rock, it was as though he'd arrived in another world. The hawks circled lazily in a bright blue sky. The jackrabbits crouched in the shade of the creosotes. Fish nibbled bread from Matt's fingers, and coyotes darted forward to gobble down chunks of his sandwiches. None of them cared whether he was a human or a clone. Matt laid out a sleeping bag under the grape arbor and used a rolled-up blanket for a pillow. He placed a thermos of orange juice within reach and selected a book. This was living. The air smelled faintly of creosote and the yellow sweetness of locust flowers. A large black wasp with scarlet wings ran over the sand, searching for the spiders that were its prey. "Hello, Brother Wasp," Matt said lazily. The insect dug furiously in the sand, found nothing, and scurried on. Matt opened a history of opium, one of the books Tamlin had left him in the chest. He expected it to be a manual about farming, but it was something quite different and exciting. Opium, Matt read, was a whole country. It was a long, thin strip of land lying between the United States and Aztlan. 100 years ago, there had been trouble between the United States and Aztlan, which was called Mexico in those days. Matt vaguely remembered Celia saying something about it. Many thousands of Mexicanos had flooded across the border in search of work. a drug dealer named Mateo Alacrán. Matt sat up straight. That was El Patrón's name. 100 years ago, he would have been a strong and active man. This person, the book went on to say, was one of the richest and most powerful men in the world, even though his business was illegal. Drugs illegal? Thought Matt. What a strange idea. Mateo Alacrán formed an alliance with the other dealers and approached the leaders of the United States and Mexico.
You have 2 problems, he said. First, you cannot control your borders, and second, you cannot control us.
He advised them to combine the problems. If both countries set aside land along their common border, the dealers would establish farms and stop the flow of illegals. In return, the dealers would promise not to sell drugs to the citizens of the United States and Mexico. They would peddle their wares in Europe, Asia, and Africa instead.
It was a pact made in hell, said the book.
Matt put it down. He couldn't see anything wrong with the plan. It seemed to have done everything it promised. He looked at the title page. The author was Esperanza Mendoza, and the Anti-Slavery Society of California was the publisher. Now that he looked more closely, he saw the book was printed on cheap yellow paper. It didn't look like something you could take seriously. Matt read on. At first, the book explained, opium was simply a no-man's land, but through the years it had prospered. Different areas were ruled by different families, much like the kingdoms of medieval Europe. A council of farmers was established, which dealt with international problems and kept peace between the various farms. Most families controlled small areas, but 2 were large enough to dictate policy. The McGregors ruled the land near San Diego, and the Alacráns had a vast empire stretching from central California all across Arizona and into New Mexico. Gradually, opium changed from a no-man's land to a real country, and its supreme leader, dictator and Führer, was Mateo Alacrán. Matt stopped reading so he could savor the words. His heart swelled with pride. He didn't know what a Führer was, but it was obviously something very good. A more evil, vicious, and self-serving man could hardly be imagined, wrote Esperanza on the next line. Matt threw the book away as hard as he could. It landed in the water with its pages open. How dare she insult El Patrón? He was a genius. How many people could build a country out of nothing? Especially someone as poor as El Patrón had been. Esperanza was simply jealous. But Matt sprang up to rescue the book before it was entirely ruined. Tamlin had given it to him, and that made it valuable. He dried it out carefully and packed it away in the metal chest. On the way back, Matt stopped at the water purification plant and talked to the foreman. Since Tamlin's departure, Matt had thought long and hard about the excellent education he'd been given. It didn't make sense for him to spend the rest of his life as an exotic pet. El Patrón didn't waste money like that. No, Matt realized. The old man meant him to have a higher destiny. He could never reach the status of Benito or Stephen, not being human, but he could help them. And so Matt had begun to study how the enterprise of running an opium empire worked. He saw how opium was planted, processed, and marketed. He watched how the ejects were moved from field to field, how often they were watered, and how many food pellets they were allowed. When I'm in charge, Matt quickly adjusted his thought, when I'm helping the person in charge, I'll free the ejects. Surely opium could be grown by normal people. They might not be as efficient, but anything was better than a mindless army of slaves. Now that Matt had observed Rosa, he understood that. He asked the plant foreman about the underground river that flowed from the Gulf of California hundreds of miles away. It was used to supply water to the Alacrán estate, but it smelled, before it was purified, terrifyingly bad. The plant foreman refused to meet Matt's eyes. Like most humans, he didn't like talking to clones, but he also didn't want to anger El Patrón.
Why does the water smell like that? Matt asked.
Dead fish. Chemicals,
the foreman replied, not looking up. But you take those out?
Yes.
Where do you put them?
Wastelands,
the man said, pointing north. He kept his answers as brief as possible. Matt shaded his eyes as he looked to the north. A heat haze shimmered over the desert,
and he saw a series of ridges that might be buildings.
There?
He asked doubtfully.
Yes,
the foreman replied. Matt turned the horse and started heading northward to get a clearer view. The smell was so vile, he feared he might have an asthma attack. He felt for his inhaler. They were buildings. They stretched in long rows with doors and dark little windows every so often. The roofs were so low, Matt wondered whether a person could stand up inside. The windows were covered with iron bars. Could this be where the Egypts lived? The idea was appalling. The closer Matt got, the stronger the stench became. It was a compound of rotten fish, excrement, and vomit, with a sweet chemical odor that was worse than the other smells put together. Matt grasped the inhaler. He knew he should leave at once, but the buildings were too intriguing. He could see skeletons of fish and seashells embedded in the dirt around them. It seemed the whole place was built on waste from the Gulf of California. Matt circled around the end of one of the buildings and rode down into a depression that must have been used for waste. The evil smell made Matt's eyes water, and he could barely focus on the dense yellow sludge on the bottom. The horse stumbled. Its legs collapsed beneath it, and Matt had to throw his arms around its neck to keep from being catapulted into the sludge.
"Get up! Get up!"
he ordered. But the horse was incapable of obeying. It sat on the ground with its legs folded up under it. Then Matt felt himself getting dizzy. He threw himself off the horse and sucked desperately at the inhaler. His lungs filled with liquid. A terror of drowning swept over him, and he tried to crawl away from the trough. His fingers dug into the rotting, fish-slimed soil. A pair of hands yanked him up. He was dragged a short way and thrown into the back of a vehicle. Matt felt the motor start. The vehicle moved away in a plume of dust that made him cough. He tried to get up and was instantly slammed down by a boot on his chest. Shocked, Matt stared up at the coldest pair of eyes he'd ever seen. At first, he thought he was looking at Tam Lin, but this person was younger and leaner. He had the same wavy brown hair and blue eyes, the same physical alertness, but none of the good humor Matt was used to seeing in the bodyguard's face.
"Where'd you get a horse?" the man demanded. "Where'd you get the brains to make a run for it?"
"He's not an Egypt, Hugh," said another voice.
Matt looked up to see another man, similar to the first one.
"Then you're an illegal," snarled Hugh. "I reckon we'll run you to the hospital and let him put a clamp in your brain."
"You do that," Matt said with his heart beating very fast. He was afraid, but Tam Lin had taught him it was foolhardy to show weakness.
"Act like you're in control," the bodyguard had said, "and 9 times out of 10, you'll get away with it. Most people are cowards underneath."
Matt realized these men belonged to the farm patrol, and thus, judging by Celia's stories, were very dangerous.
"You do that," Matt repeated, "and I'll tell the doctor how you treated El Patron's clone."
"Say what?"
said Hugh, lifting his boot from Matt's chest.
"I'm El Patron's clone. I was visiting the water purification plant and got lost. Better yet, you can take me to the big house, and I'll send a message to him."
Matt was very far from feeling confident, but he'd observed El Patron give orders many times. He knew exactly how to reproduce the cold, deadly voice that got results.
"Crikey, even sounds like the old vampire," said the second man.
"Shut your cake-hole," snarled Hugh. "Look, we weren't expecting you out there, Master, Master, what do we call you?"
"Mateo Alacrán,"
Matt said, and was gratified to see the men flinch.
"Well, Master Alacrán, we weren't expecting you, and you were by the Egypt pens, so it was a natural mistake."
"Did it occur to you to ask what I was doing out there?"
Matt said, narrowing his eyes, as El Patron did when he wanted to be particularly menacing.
"I know we should have, sir. We're really very, very sorry. We're taking you straight to the big house, and we're most humbly begging your pardon, aren't we, Rafe?"
"Oh, yeah, indeed," said the second man. "What about my horse?" "We'll fix that up."
Rafe banged on the cab of the truck. A window opened, and he shouted instructions inside.
"We'll radio for a patrol to collect the nag. It was in a bad way from the dead air, sir. It might not survive."
"Dead air?" said Matt, startled enough to drop out of his El Patron act. It sometimes happens around that trough, said Rafe. The air doesn't move, and the carbon dioxide builds up. It's like being in a mine.
I lost a brother like that, remarked Hugh.
You can't tell until it's too late, said Rafe.
The nearby pens are usually okay, but on still nights, we make the Egypt sleep in the fields.
Matt was amazed.
Why don't you clean up the trough?
Rafe seemed honestly puzzled by the idea.
It's how we've always done things, Master Alacran. The Egypts don't care.
Well, that's true, thought Matt. Even if the Egypts knew about the danger, they couldn't flee unless they were ordered to do so.
Now that Matt appeared to accept the men's apology, they became almost friendly. They didn't act like most people did when told Matt was a clone. They were wary, but not hostile. In fact, they behaved a lot like Tamlin.
Are you Scottish? Matt asked.
Oh, no, said Hugh. Rafe here is from England, and I'm from Wales. Wee Willie in the cab is Scottish, though. But we all like to play soccer and thump heads.
Matt remembered something El Patron had said long ago about Tamlin and Daft Donald.
I picked up this lad in Scotland, breaking heads outside a soccer field. Always choose your bodyguards from another country. They'll find it harder to make alliances and betray you.
Soccer sounds a lot like war, Matt said. Both Rafe and Hugh laughed.
It is, lad. It is, said Hugh.
The fine thing about soccer, said Rafe with a distant look in his eyes, is that you enjoy both the game and the trimmings.
Trimmings? Matt said.
Oh, yes. That which surrounds the game, the build-up, the crush of fans in the trains.
The parties,
said Hugh with a dreamy look on his face.
The parties, agreed Rafe. You crowd into a pub with your mates and drink until the owner throws you out.
If he can throw you out, Hugh amended.
And then, either before or after, you run into the fans on the other side. So, of course, you have to set them straight.
That's when the head thumping occurs, Matt guessed.
Yes, nothing finer, especially if you win, said Rafe.
The truck followed a zigzag course through the poppy fields. Matt saw the same Egypts he'd observed that morning. They were still bending over the ripe seed pods, but he felt no impulse to call them brothers. They weren't brothers, and never would be, until they lost the clamps in their brains.
If you liked it so much, why did you come here? Matt asked Hugh and Rafe.
The men lost their dreamy expressions. Their eyes became cold and distant.
Sometimes, Hugh began, and then fell silent.
Sometimes the head thumping goes too far, Rafe finished for him. It's okay to kill people in a war, then you're a hero. But in soccer, which is every bit as glorious, you're supposed to shake hands with the enemy afterward.
Kiss his ruddy backside, more like, said Hugh in disgust.
We didn't like that, see?
Matt thought he understood. Hugh, Rafe, and Wee Wooly in the cab were murderers. They were the ideal candidates for the farm patrol. They would have to be loyal to El Patron, or he would dump them into the arms of whatever police were looking for them. The lush gardens and red tile roofs of the big house were visible now. Nothing could have been further from the long, low dwellings where the Egypts lived. That is, when they weren't sleeping in the fields to keep from being gassed.
Did Tamlin kill anyone? Matt said.
He didn't much want to ask, but this might be his only opportunity to find out. Hugh and Rafe exchanged looks.
He's in a class by himself, said Rafe. He's a blight terrorist.
Can't think why El Patron trusts him so much, said Hugh.
They're like father and son.
Put a cork in it. Can't you see who we're talking to? Hugh said.
The house was near, and Matt was afraid they'd let him out before he learned what he wanted to know.
What did Tamlin do? He urged.
Only set a bomb outside the Prime Minister's house in London, replied Hugh. He was a Scottish nationalist, see. Wanted to bring back Bonnie Prince Charlie or some other fat slug. He wasn't motivated by beer like the rest of us.
No, he's a cut above, Rafe said, with his fancy ethics and social conscience.
It's a shame a school bus pulled up at the wrong moment, said Hugh. The blast killed 20 kiddies.
That's what social conscience gets you,
Rafe said as he helped Matt climb down. The truck drove off at once. The men seemed eager to get away, or perhaps